Well, boys, looks like you started the fun without me.
You're all sick. Every last one of you.
We're going to need a bigger gun.
What's the matter? You're scared of things that go boom, boom, boom.
Give me one goddamn reason why I shouldn't blow your goddamn brains all over that goddamn wall.
My name is Eric, and I'm joined today by double feature co-host Michael Kester.
Good to be here.
And we're going to talk about some troubled individuals today on the show, clashing with the status quo. I think we might also have some secret roadsploitation inspirations as well.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say maybe even both of the movies. I don't know. What are we doing today on the show?
Today we're doing Bartleby and Rebel Without a Cause.
So those are two things we're definitely going to spoil. But given that this is the sixth year, and the listeners have also brought us some incredible things, I want to talk about the, let's call it short film, Hello Gracie, Executive Koala, which is the, as Tim Kaiser puts it, the greatest video on YouTube. Now, I feel like without just plugging his, maybe that's the best way to go, is just to plug this and people can go see it for themselves. It's tinyurl.com/HelloGracie. That's HelloGracie, like you would expect it
right,
to be.
Sure.
But I, you know, for people who don't just want to go into it cold, and maybe they weren't around during the famous Tim Kaiser bits of our show, how would you describe this individual?
He did for us what Double Feature does for Podmanity.
Yeah.
You and I come on here once a week, and we talk about films that we watch, and we try to make it enjoyable and relatable and fun. And we try to be two people that you can relate to and kind of experience films with.
Right.
And in being those people, it's difficult to find somebody who will take the meta to the next level.
Right.
Tim Kaiser was that guy.
Kaiser's the originator, man.
Yeah.
He's the beginning of things like Double Feature Ripoff and Film Shack.
Yeah. Tim Kaiser sent us these files that he would record, ostensibly just holding his phone in his hand while he watched the film, which is
still better than how we do our show.
Yeah, it's something that you and I continue to talk about how we can do, is basically live podcasting the films as we watch them.
Right.
But Tim's reactions to these things are just exactly what go on through your head while you're watching the movie. But it's the kind of stuff that, you know, an hour later when we're sitting and talking about them on Double Feature, we forget about the visceral reaction of crazy Japanese people.
Right. Well, that was his famous line that stirred up all the controversy on our show. Tim Kaiser has no filter, which is one of my favorite things about him. And it's literally a stream of what goes through an individual's mind as they're watching a film, especially when that individual is a character such as Tim. And Tim is also one of the few listeners of this show that purposefully, anyways, I've ever met outside of, you know, running into somebody by happenstance or at a film event or something. And God, has been listening to our show for the longest of time. Just a great fucking guy. And he did this thing on Executive Koala, which, have you ever seen Executive Koala?
No.
Of course you haven't. Why would you? Executive Koala is a Japanese movie, I assume. I haven't seen it either. I've only seen his thing on it. But it's a totally straight drama, except one of the characters is a koala. And the way they do this is not either of the ways that would probably be better, the terrible Kangaroo Jack CG way, or just have a koala hanging out on the set, but rather a guy in a koala suit, a really bad koala head, but the koala wears a suit.
Okay.
Right? So it's a Japanese businessman with a koala head, just in business drama situations. It's really bizarre. And I want to say Tim's commentary makes it more bizarre, because Tim's commentaries are usually kind of bizarre, but I think it actually grounds it more in reality, just knowing that someone else is watching this and going,
exactly,
what the
correct
fuck is happening?
Yeah.
Anyways, tinyurl.com/HelloGracie. This wasn't even to us. This was to Gracie. So this is something Tim recorded for someone else and then put on YouTube for the world to see. And it's amazing. Anyways, there's spoilers in this show and chapters I should have told you about earlier. We're going to spoil Bartleby and then we're going to spoil Rebel Without a Cause. So skip over those if you haven't seen them. But I would advise you just pause the show now and watch them if you can't figure out the chapters. Where did you see Bartleby?
Well,
I have a sneaking suspicion it's the same place I did, so I wanted to know.
Well, you know, Bartleby is Netflix. It's backwards how I found out about Bartleby, but
oh, interesting.
I did end up seeing it on Netflix. I was reading about there's this movie that's out. It's called like Moby Dick 2050 or something.
Sure. Yeah, I'm aware of this.
You're aware of this? Okay.
Yeah, strangely. I don't know.
So
not
I went
even
on,
through doing stuff for the show.
So I went on Wikipedia knowing Herman Melville did Moby Dick.
Right.
And just kind of on this rampant tirade of why Herman Melville's Moby Dick keeps getting made in 2058.
Right.
I'm pissed off and I go, why don't any of his other books get turned into movies?
It's Herman fucking Melville, man.
Yeah. And
as this movie purports, one of the most popular English language writers of what, all time?
Yeah.
I mean, he made Moby Dick. Everybody sure knows what Moby Dick is.
So I started looking through his... It's very similar to what I ended up doing with Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's all Blade Runner, Blade Runner, Blade Runner. And I'm right. All, he's done other movies. Right. But I can't name them.
Right. So God, that's why we talk about him so often is that, you know, what, 20 of his books have been made
yeah.
into films?
Yeah.
I think more of his books have been made into films than he had books in the first place.
I think that's true. And so that I found out about Bartleby the Scrivener, the book.
Sure.
And then I look into that, see that there's a film adaptation, find out that it's starring Crispin Glover. Immediately that jumps to the top of my list of things I need to see in my life.
Right, right.
And there it was sitting on Netflix.
Yeah, this is probably Jonathan Parker's most famous film.
Yeah.
Which is why you have to watch it on Netflix. It's not an easy to find movie by any means. So once again, we're going to keep praising Netflix unsponsored because I love everything about them and that it's made our job so much easier for finding these weird little movies. I think so many people go on Netflix and go, man, all that's on here is weird little movies. What about the blockbusters I want to see?
Yeah.
I'm one of the few people who I think goes, oh, I wonder if that's on Netflix. And it actually is.
Yeah.
I don't think that happens for a lot of people.
I always go on Netflix and I look through, you know, I'll look through an entire genre, but I'll scroll past the first 10
right.
rows. Because I'm looking at a genre and I go, yeah, I know that. I've seen that. And that's, I don't care about that. And let's move on past Transformers.
Sure.
And see if Bartleby is on here.
So this is a movie that I think might be more questions than answers. It's not pointed as far as this is what I want you to think or this is what to come away with. Maybe so much as getting the audience to go, how do I feel about this? Or where, you know... Where does the morality lie in this thing or that thing? What would you do here? It's kind of a series of thought experiments.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read Moby Dick, but you know, I'm really curious about how popular it is and how, I don't know, just nothing has ever enticed me to go read Moby Dick. It's something Penn Jillette talks about all the fucking time, though, as
yeah.
one of his favorite books, and he reads it all the time. You know, it's kind of what keeps Herman Melville on my radar. But man, seeing that bit at the beginning about him taking a job as a clerk and dying at 72 and nobody knew who he was. And then I feel even worse about not reading Moby Dick.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, it's not like he's that obscure. I should probably just know what's going on in here. So I can't speak as a Herman Melville expert, but I can hypothesize that Moby Dick may be kind of the same. And if it's, you know, thought experiments, I'm all for that.
Well, Moby Dick is a lot more about, obsessions getting you into bad situations.
Sure.
And Bartleby is, it's weird because the film presents itself initially as a very basic, simple movie. And it seems like it's about taking control of your own life and not being pushed around. And then that moves quickly into giving up on everything around you.
Well, yeah, it starts in that office kind of, you know, the when we did Shaun of the Dead and Glengarry Glen Ross, that kind of setting.
Sure.
Where, especially with Ernie talking about, if you don't care, why do you ask?
Yeah.
You know, which I totally align with that whole, man, not to bog down our show with corporate world stuff, but that you'd see everybody on Monday and they say these words, these fucking four words that kill me. How was your weekend? Oh, I just hate it.
Yeah.
It's just like, how you doing today? Nobody wants an answer. It just, I don't know. I, obviously, there's a big chunk on it in Bartleby. I don't mean to be redundant. But yeah, that was my expectation too, is to have a an office place kind of film. And, you know, I think it's when we start to get all this stuff about the dead letters, especially knowing the three sentences of knowledge I have from earlier in the film about Herman Melville, that kind of changes it from their description of low pay, no benefits, dull job that I really like. They set themselves up for that. And then once you move into 8-year dead letter kind of job,
sure,
this becomes something a lot heavier, I think.
Yeah. Well, and oddly, it's still funny.
Sure.
Which is kind of weird for me, because when we were first going into this film, I presented it to you as, okay, this movie is kind of like a mix of an 80s sitcom and a David Lynch movie.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is the way it looks. Everything is really, it's just single color palette.
Sure.
There's a yellow wall and a purple wall. The floor is blue. And the characters are so stereotypical. There's a guy named Rocky who always wants to fight. He's wearing the scrapping suspenders.
Yeah.
And there's a interesting character is the flirtatious and loquacious secretary.
Right.
But the workplace itself seems like it's taken out of the 80s, where you're kind of in a cubicle and you're doing mundane office work, but everybody's got this nightlife,
yeah,
you know, that they go off to. But the comedy and the pacing and the way the camera moves and the fact that Crispin Glover is in it at all gives it this weird, eerie, like you said, this depth that the film seems like it has no place to have.
Right.
But once you get there, it seems like now every workplace comedy should have that depth. And you're just not seeing it because they haven't hired Bartleby yet.
Right. Like, everyone's going to get to that point. This is the next logical step after the workplace comedy. That's where we start to move into a lot of the isolation kind of themes. Once we get, you know, we establish the workplace, we establish that it's dull. The film itself is shot in this kind of dreamlike, surreal, the score's a theremin in it.
I mean,
it's just, you know what I mean? It is bizarre. It is surreal. And then the dead letter stuff comes up, which I also wonder if that's Melville's kind of feelings about his own, you know, we find out that he became a clerk. He had a dull job, maybe self-fulfilling prophecy more so than him actually predicting the future.
Right.
But then to have these works that, I mean, I've read that Melville may have considered his works dead letters. And I don't know if that's people reading into, you know, something that he said in one of his books, but you think about that with Moby Dick, too, with the exception of perhaps Penn Jillette. I have never heard anyone go, Moby Dick, yeah, that's my favorite novel.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you wonder, as you're creating things, it's a fear that lingers in you of, will anyone ever see this? Is this just going to die off? And in 50 years, it'll basically cease to exist. Your legacy will be gone because people will have, you know, dead letters, people will have forgotten about it. Everybody you wrote it to, your core audience will have, basically they'll have all died and your work will end up nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then in comes Bartleby.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first fucking thing you learn. I mean, how heavy is that? And you're right too, Crispin Glover, I mean, a better choice has seldom been made.
Yeah.
It's as if he is haunting their building.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's basically a ghost.
Yeah.
He starts off as this, you know, he's doing the job perfectly. and they ask him to do one thing that's not in his job description.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I was saying, where it feels like the film is about empowerment in your Monday, almost like Office Space when they're, what, do they beat up a
sure.
printer? Is right. that what they're doing?
Yes, that's...
It's like this empowering, I'm going to take back what this mundane job has taken from me. And Bartleby says, I prefer not to.
Sure.
And it becomes the mantra to every working class individual who's watching the film, every working class individual in the film, and the bane of every employer's existence.
Sure.
Because it's simple, and it's not forceful, and it's honest, and it's not a blunt refusal.
Yeah.
Which allows you to simply say, I'd prefer not to. And your boss has to then double think, well, do I now force them to do something they
sure
don't want to do?
It's where we create the thought experiments.
Exactly. It's where
you can't not think about that, you know?
It's perfect. And it's so simple.
We'll also talk about the power of language, right?
Right.
I just mentioned the four worst words being, how sure. was your weekend? Or, you know,
yeah.
how's your day going? Or whatever. I prefer not to, coincidentally, conveniently, also four words.
Yeah.
So incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
It forces you to just go, okay, if I was at my job and I said these words, what would happen?
Sure.
If I was in a social situation, if I was at a dinner party, if I was in human fucking conversation and someone asked of me anything and I said I prefer not to, I mean, it fucking shakes the core of the person who
sure.
asked the question.
Well,
what do they do?
Yeah, well, it's wonderful because you're not being disrespectful and you're mm-hmm. not outright saying no. It's not, no, you do it.
Right.
And it's also not, it's not as bad as kind of letting your shoulders slump and going, all right.
Sure.
You know, that's the passive aggressive, I don't want to, but I guess I will.
Right.
By simply saying, I prefer not to, it heightens yourself to a point where now they know you don't want to do the thing. And they will then have to ask you a second time, knowing your preference is against it.
It's weird how you find phrases like that and, I don't know, just powerful pieces of language that create this forced sort of Pavlovian response in people.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's where something like, you know, how's your day going? Where that comes from is just people become trained on it. It becomes routine. It's something that, I mean, you run up against another person and you have to say something to greet them or to start conversation, and that's where that comes from. You know, I think it's possible to maybe look at that as the same way as when everyone starts to parrot the I prefer not to, or the word prefer.
Right.
You know, they notice this this power, it creeps up on them. Maybe they notice the power sort of subliminally, or maybe you're just around a phrase long enough and you start to pick up cues or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but there are, strangely, I mean, that stuff really is effective. It's almost hypnotic.
Yeah.
I've noticed that too when you're in a group of people, you know, you're trying to get out of a meeting or you're, you know, you basically want to end an encounter. The word thank you, you can just say thank you very confidently and then turn around and book.
Yeah.
And it will get you out of literally any situation. It's beautiful. Everyone will stand up instead of going, are we done here? Is everybody good? All things resolved. Can we, you know, thank you, bye. So the language stuff is a bigger question, and I don't know, that's just it's a particular area of interest I didn't realize I had until watching this, that I'm gonna kind of
mm-hmm.
look out for more, I guess. But the thing that the movie is really, really sinking its teeth into is the questions about morality and responsibility.
Sure.
I mean, if you want to talk about something you can't, you know, not think about, I think that's really where the core of the film is. It's testing limits and, you know, in the extent of thought experiments. If you're the type of person who plays thought experiments, the word responsibility, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have this guy, this ghost of a person who is kind of bringing you into a weird situation using the power of language and this language that you're not accustomed to hearing. And I prefer not to causes you to really question, how do I react to that?
Right.
And seeing the reactions of these individuals, specifically his boss, I mean, I think the big question is, what are the limits? Does his boss do everything he can? I mean, first of all right, so you've hired this guy. He's in your office. He's doing this thing. What do you feel like your responsibility is?
Well, at first, I'm right in line with him the entire time.
With his boss or with?
With his boss. Yeah. You can't be. Think of where he ends up.
Sure, yeah. Well, no, Bartleby is a catalyst. He's not someone to identify with.
But I would go through pretty much the same motions as my initial reaction would be, okay, well, he prefers not to do that. And I guess I didn't hire him on to do that. So I can't.
Perhaps. I mean, maybe it's part of his job description. I don't know.
Well, no, because see, we know the job. He tells him he needs to file. And then he's just got to carry a box. Is that what it is eventually? He's carrying a box.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the nature of the work. But, sorry, I didn't mean to.
So initially, my reaction would be the same. And it'd be, well, that's, I guess, technically not what we hired him for. And then I would get to the point where I go, well, if you refuse to do your job, we're going to have to let you go.
Right.
And right around the time I come back from work that weekend and he's still in the office, I think I would call the police then.
Yeah.
I would call the police. I would call, what is it, 311? Is that the non-emergency hotline?
I don't know.
I don't want to call.
We have international listeners. That means nothing to them.
I don't want to call the police that are going to show up and beat the hell out of him. Right. You know, I don't want to call Istanbul tear gas police. I want to call normal, rational police.
Oh God, I'm not touching that. But you're right. So it's hard to fire him, but that's something that eventually does have to come up. You just go, well, if you're not going to do the thing we need you to do, you're gone. And it's easy to be stern about it then, but something just snaps into place where you realize he has a problem.
Right.
If that is a normal, rational operating human being, then you go, you know what, man, you're fired. We need someone with some drive. Get the fuck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But he's living there, so you become sympathetic again.
Right.
You know, you go, oh, well, wow, this guy's really got some problems. Maybe I should, you know, be a human fucking being and help him out.
Well, suddenly it goes from firing him to turning him into a homeless person.
Right. Well, and also there's that question of some type of disorder that comes about too. So now you're not just forcing a guy who refuses to do work into being homeless, but you're creating, you know, the type of homeless person I think most people could agree needs help.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
Or is blameless. Or, I mean, the type of homeless individual who has some sort of deficiency that prevents them from doing the types of activities that would put them into a home.
Right.
Mainly working, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who's homeless because they can't work, and they can't work because they might have ADD or something.
Sure, but at the same time, the thought experiment gets deeper because he's technically refusing on his own grounds.
Sure.
He's not unable to work.
Well, maybe not physically, but perhaps mentally.
Well, I mean, maybe, yeah. But
don't you think there's at least a blurry line there?
I think so, but the way he comes in and the way he... his job interview.
Right.
And do you remember why he lost his previous job?
The office move?
Right, which ends up being what goes on in this film. And so that's where you go, right, the office moved, because you can't take Bartleby out of the office. So you have to take the office away from Bartleby.
Well, that's also part of that cyclical or kind of dual nature that shows up through the whole movie between the mimicking of his language in other people, but then also this sort of looking like a cycle, like it's almost repeating itself over and over, which makes it seem even more doomed than it was originally. But okay, so moving that office is, you know, we start thinking maybe his boss is just the greatest guy in the world. He's going through all these lengths to help him out. But there's also scenes where you see that his boss just wants as little of a problem as possible. And that's what makes me think, all right, are we talking about morality still? Or now are we talking about getting rid of a pest?
Right.
Are we talking about a haunted house that you're trying to abandon? Right. I mean, his boss is kind of living as this isolationist. I identify that because I feel like I'm a little bit the same way. I don't want to get involved in other people's business. If you're having a problem and that's kind of Venn diagram overlapping into my problems. I'm just going to try and encapsulate a little more and scoot away from you.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that reaction with Bartleby, and I don't think that's an altruistic thing. I think that's, God, I really just don't want any more confrontation with Bartleby, and I don't want to have to, you know, call the police because I'll feel like a bad guy. So I don't want to inconvenience someone else. I'll just pick up my entire life and move away from him.
Right.
Which, I mean, would you agree that that's probably what's going on there, or is he still in the on the path of altruism?
No, I think he's trying to circumvent an actual decision.
Yeah.
The thing that's so interesting about the final moves that the manager makes is that eventually he is doing everything in his power to get around doing what is an actual motion.
Sure.
He starts acting out the notion of I prefer not to.
Yeah, basically.
He could make a move to remove Bartleby by calling the police, but I'll just move the office.
Yeah, I really would not like to do that.
So he starts, you know, give me a plate. Well, you have to stand in line. I'd prefer not to stand in line. Right. You have to stand in line.
Which really just extends your thought experiment problems.
Sure.
Because then you get back to the end of the movie and you start wondering, okay, well, I had a really good notion of why he's doing this because he prefers not to. His boss, I mean.
Sure.
And then you see him stand in line to get him food all the way up to trying to make the book of the story.
Sure.
And you have to question a lot of these actions and really figure out, you know, where's the line? What is he doing on the side of he's trying to do what's right for Bartleby, who he feels sorry for? And what is he doing simply because he can't be bothered anymore? Right. So back in 1955, we had this movie, Rebel Without a Cause.
Uh-huh. Familiar.
Which seems like one of those origin points for our show that has somehow been neglected. It's a Nicholas Ray movie. And I mentioned Nicholas Ray because I think, I mean, of the many pieces of Rebel Without a Cause that are influential, Nicholas Ray had a huge influence on French New Wave, which is another area of cinema that's been neglected on our show. But that's, we've skirted around it so much. I mean, that's where Auteur Theory started. That's, you know, we see Nicholas Ray being writer-director, a really good early example of that and, you know, being influential on that.
Sure.
But French New Wave was, man, that was existentialism, absurdism, movies stylistically with really long takes or tracking shots. It's a little bit like our Orson Welles and our Hitchcock and noir, but with a little more of the two-lane blacktop type of exploitation.
Sure.
And then thinking about French New Wave being a combination of those two things, coming back again to Rebel Without a Cause and saying, well, this was kind of an influence, but also had to be an influence on roadsploitation movies.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Even if they don't like it, you know, even if they point to other things, the things they're pointing to might be French New Wave, which honestly is just pointing back to Rebel Without a Cause.
Right. Well, and the other thing that Rebel Without a Cause is kind of a first for on our show, and again, we're circumventing the actual thing here, because we rarely get into big Hollywood, like the Hollywood of the 30s and 40s and 50s.
Sure.
We, you know, we've done movies regarding Charlie Chaplin or starring the Marx Brothers.
Right.
But we often don't get into Cary Grant. We often shy away from, you know, something like Gone with the Wind. It's not because those films aren't great and don't have a place in cinema, but it's because
they certainly do.
For 1955, every film before Rebel Without a Cause doesn't look good under the double feature text.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Right, I know what you mean.
I don't mean that in a literal sense, although a little. I mean that Rebel Without a Cause kind of is the foundation of everything that double feature has. I mean, Rebel Without a Cause to me feels like the beginning of exploitation.
Yeah.
Even though it's still big Hollywood, you still have James Dean and the big score and everything still, you know, looks like sound stages.
Well, that's an interesting thing to think about, because it's, I kind of feel like that question of where does exploitation begin is one of the, you know, the underlying, it's one of the things we don't really talk about on our show, but we're always interested in, can we find that?
Right. Well, we did find Freaks.
It in a, Yeah, we find it in a lot of places.
Yeah.
Todd Browning's Freaks certainly comes to mind. I think even if we go as old as Fritz Lang's M,
mm-hmm.
you know, we find Origins of Noir, which is kind of inspirational to a lot of types of exploitation itself.
Sure.
May have been one of the most popular forms of exploitation. I think that's the only thing that causes people not to think about it as mm-hmm. an exploitation genre is how fucking popular it was. But later movies, I mean, if we're going to use modern exploitation and we're just going to point to Grindhouse for everything.
Right.
We can also go, well, yeah, Sin City is kind of that stuff. And Sin City is noir stuff. And noir stuff is kind of Fritz Lang's M.
Yeah.
It's a very sensitive web you sort of weave out of that.
Uh-huh.
I thought you were immediately going to Dennis Hopper, but I guess you're invoking James Dean a little bit. But while we're just looking at the origins of things, this is some old Dennis Hopper
I
here.
I think this is this young, might be as it were. This might be one of the earliest, if not the earliest, Dennis Hopper.
Well, but we're also talking Easy Rider was probably
Easy Rider.
Earliest thing we've done so far.
Yeah, and Easy Rider's 14 years after this film.
Right. It's a bit like finding Jack Nicholson in Little Shop of Horrors.
Yeah.
But James Dean is the real legend on display here. And I have no problem coming on here and just pleading ignorance and going, why is James Dean a legend?
Sure.
This is, here's things I did not know about James Dean prior okay. to looking stuff up for this show. Had only done 3 films
mm-hmm.
and died at 24.
Yeah.
Now, it would be very easy for me to say, well, I did see Rebel Without a Cause and I realize he's a colossal performer. And so, you know, thusly, he deserves fame.
Sure.
But I'm not even talking about being deserving of fame. I'm talking about a guy who has the kind of lore and legend around him, like, you know, a Clint Eastwood.
Sure.
Like a person who has been in the Hollywood mainstream system
mm-hmm.
for 3 fucking decades.
Right.
Instead of 3 fucking films.
Right. Well, and the thing that is most interesting to me about James Dean is he became the poster child for so much so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
He was Hollywood's bad boy. You know, he's kind of the portraiture of the phrase live fast and die young.
Sure.
Leave a beautiful corpse.
Sure.
And having done so little work in film, it's interesting to kind of go, well, where did all that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of it is because he was one of the earliest big Hollywood stars to die so suddenly. We actually, oddly enough, on Double Feature, saw pretty accurately what the crash that James Dean died in looked like when we watched Crash.
Sure.
And they reenact the car accident that killed James Dean.
But look at that. You have cult movie,
right.
Cronenberg, talking about the James
sure.
Dean stuff.
And
that's not the only time that's come up on our show. In fact, there's probably some way to link, you know, every third movie back to Rebel
sure.
Without a Cause.
But the thing I think the legacy of James Dean is this notion of such a talented young artist and everything he could have been and everything he may have been that we will never, there's all this speculation
mm-hmm.
that, you know, he would have gone on to become, you know, multiple Academy Award winner, James Dean changed the look of film for all of cinema. There's also a bunch of speculation that he might have been gay.
Oh, sure.
Plus he's just incredibly good looking and an incredible actor.
Right.
I mean, he has everything going for him. And the other thing is if you go online and you Google James Dean.
That's like a Bing search.
Sure. And one of the 3 films that he actually was credited in.
Oh, sure.
You will recognize him in the outfits from each film. He's in 3 films and all of his get-ups are already cult icons
sure.
as James Dean as a cowboy. James Dean in a red jacket. I mean, these are images that have gone on to become stereotypes in cinema. I mean, if you think of the quintessential Hollywood bad boy, then especially if you're going to call the era out,
mm-hmm.
1950s bad boy,
right?
You're going to get a white t-shirt and jeans, smoking a cigarette, slicked hair, you know, looking, you know, kind of down,
right,
but up at the same time. I mean, it's James Dean in Rebel Without a Cause.
Well, and I think so many movies that have that 50s grease thing
mm-hmm.
that we go back to are, even if they're not being true to themselves, even if they're not acknowledging it on their own, I think they, you know, they want to be cool, like Rebel Without a Cause a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, if I could bring this into a more contemporary setting for our 90s loving audience, it made me think about Brandon Lee a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? About that all that could have been, you know, huge star, very iconic.
Yeah.
Again, really iconic get up.
Sure.
You know, people still think about The Crow. I'm not nearly in the sense they do.
Right.
As Rebel Without a Cause. But we talked about that a lot when we did The Crow, you know, and that makeup and the way it looks, and that they tried to make all these sequels after it, and people latched on to, I mean, there's a lot of reasons maybe those sequels didn't take off, but I think people latched on to the Brandon Lee part of it,
mm-hmm.
like people latch on to James Dean
sure.
so many years later. So he comes in and he's trying to make friends in a new place. And this is where we get into a lot of the other stuff that I think people don't, you know, they associate Rebel Without a Cause so much with James Dean. It's possible to overlook a multitude of other things that it's doing that are really unique for the time. He's a character that is, we think of him today as, like you said, Hollywood bad boy, total tough guy. And he is the tough guy in this movie until the other pack of kids show up and try and be tough guys.
Sure.
And they just seem, I mean, they just seem like assholes by comparison.
They seem like a horrible mob.
Yeah, exactly. And so that allows us to instantly root for a guy who in 1955, we might have had a little trouble
sure.
rooting for.
Sure.
If he was, you know, 30, 40, 50 years old and trying to be the bad boy, I think Hollywood has accepted that in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But man, being that young, he would just be a troublemaker.
Sure.
This would be a story of purification, you know, that kind of moral tale. And then when these other kids show up, I love that, you know, fucking nine of them try and pack into a car or whatever. That's a really iconic image for me too.
Sure.
They seem like fucking hoodlums. And by contrast, you know, Stark has to be the hero of the story mm-hmm. because he's now the downtrodden, you know, he's the one being unfairly attacked by
right.
all the kids at school. It's weird because with the legend that is James Dean, I'm seeing this movie for our show right now for the first time. So I had imagined this would all be about James Dean, you know, causing trouble and being an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And to see that he is the underdog in this film, I mean, that was a really surprising thing for me given what you associate him with now.
Right.
You know, when we joke about playing that game on the show of who is the real Rebel Without a Cause, you know, I feel like I'm straying towards everyone but Jim. Jim seems purely justified in his emotional drama, whereas everybody else is just kind of being a jerk for no reason.
Right.
Past even the character James Dean is playing, though, I think a big part of the legacy is the line, you're tearing me apart, later to be followed with the word Lisa.
Lisa?
No, that was not.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say the chicken game
uh-huh.
is, oh my God. There's been frame by frame tributes to this on our show.
Uh-huh.
Although rarely with the same result as we get. That's usually how movies put their own unique spin on it. But God, I can think of, it's so hard to come up with the specifics, right? But I know this is it's something that Footloose did soon after. The Fast and the Furious franchise, I'm pretty sure every fucking movie, you know, anytime there's two cars racing, you get that really iconic, I mean, girl in the middle flags the cars, they mm-hmm. race by. The way the camera pans around, don't quote me on my Fast and the Furious knowledge, but that awful third movie, Tokyo Drift, I'm pretty sure it starts this way.
Yeah.
I could be totally wrong, which I would be okay with, but I'm pretty sure it's just a direct ripoff of this. Any scene with a drag race anywhere, I would be really interested if listeners want to come up with a list of, I don't know, we'll keep it light. We'll say the first 50 movies they can think of that just copy the chicken scene here. That's how you know that you've made something that really worked, that created suspense, that did the things it was supposed to do, is that so long after it's been mimicked so many times, it's lived on in American cinema. And then I also think about the inspiration of Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah.
I don't know, how is Rebel Without a, just in the Robert Rodriguez realm, how has Rebel Without a Cause not come up more on our show?
It
just seems unfair.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, Rebel Without a Cause was a really scary thing because of its big Hollywood ties.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like big Hollywood is an extra couple generations beyond my reach of,
sure,
of film.
Sure.
My reach ends at the late 60s. That's where I can grasp something like Easy Rider,
right,
fully understand it, fully relate to it. Because as a child of the 90s, the 70s is just what the 90s brought back. You know what I mean?
Sure. Sure.
The 50s is the twice removed 90s.
Right.
And there's all this, there's all the McCarthyism.
Sure.
And I couldn't tell you, you know, I don't know the presidential order through the 50s the way I do through the 60s and 70s.
Right.
So I'm out of my depth when we hit 50s Hollywood. And so Rebel Without a Cause just has always kind of scared me.
Right.
So maybe that's why, because Robert Rodriguez is never for me about being afraid to talk about it.
I mean, when we, you know, when we looked at Road Racers,
yeah,
Road Racers is a living tribute, or yes, perhaps a now dead tribute. No, fuck it. Road Racers got a DVD release. Let's call it a living tribute to Rebel Without a Cause. But I also think about that theme in so much of the other stuff Robert Rodriguez does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about, I mean, there was his infamous book, obviously, Rebel Without a Crew, which is, you know, taking the title from that. But also The Faculty.
Yeah.
We talk so much about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but it's that same kind of, you know, cliques of kids clashing and trying to, you know, find your place in a social peer group of some sort. That element of family that's important to Rodriguez, I think, is in complete contrast with Rebel Without a Cause, seeing the breakdown of the family unit.
Sure.
And then, you know, it's an interesting place for him to find inspiration, given how important family is in his work.
Right.
You know, you might say that things like the Spy Kids franchise might have been created as the antithesis to Rebel Without a Cause,
mm-hmm,
to go, you know, I don't ever want to have those disjointed parents. Maybe that's what kind of attracts him to the movie. So if you're saying, all right, Hollywood 50s, little inaccessible, you do know some 50s Hollywood cliches.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, think about the treatment of parents in this movie,
mm-hmm,
versus other 50s Hollywood movies.
Right.
It's crazy that this even happened.
Sure.
You know, if I want to really hold Rebel Without a Cause up for doing anything that I feel like, okay, this is where it planted its flag in history. Man, standing up and having, you know, so we have this lone teenager. It's not a purity moral tale, like I was saying. That's one thing on its own. But then to dive immediately into the emotion and the drama right from the beginning of the movie, of him laying on the ground, him having the breakdown, really emotional breakdown at the police station, and then getting immediately into his parents, which is, if you're going to ask the question of what is the cause of, uh-huh, Rebel Without a Cause, you go, oh, well, it's his parents.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very clearly, he's trying to fit in. Why does he have problems fitting in? Oh, he's, you know, he's a bad boy. Why is he such a bad boy? Why is he always causing trouble, getting into knife fights that the police don't stop? I love that cop watching them fight and just goes, trouble. Just stands there like, thanks. This is definitely not a movie that's putting the adults in the, I mean, this is what I would expect it in the 50s. The adults are the moral compass. The family unit is the perfect thing at home. Wife, husband, 2.5 kids, dog that runs around in the yard. This was the 50s family. The 50s family should be your guidance, not your source of conflict.
Right.
The cop is the one who stands up for justice. Not, you know, leans against the back wall with his arms crossed talking to the fucking planetarium guy. So here's the flag planting for me. It's in seeing his parents fight, in seeing the unconventional portrayal of parents, in seeing parents as a parents and family and authority, all as a negative influence.
Right.
Every sense of authority in this movie is negative influence. Aside from the, you know, the cop showing up in the end of the movie, but I guess you could even make the argument that that's where the most violence comes in, is at,
sure,
the, you know, the hands of the police. For a movie to stand up in the 50s and go, here's what a troubled family unit looks like, that is extremely unconventional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were having trouble in the 50s with the idea of husband and wife sleeping in the same bed,
right?
Let alone on the verge of divorce the D word in the 50s, something we don't talk about, or domestic abuse. Sources of real conflict that really existed in the 50s. We've forgotten that those were even around in the 50s because we don't see them in art from that era.
Right.
And Rebel Without a Cause stood right there and said, this is a thing that exists. And furthermore, if you were to ask yourself the question, you may say that this is actually why this guy has so much trouble, because he has a, you know, a broken family unit and no authority in his life. Also, repressed memories aren't real. And that's really, that's the end of, I feel like I have a moral obligation to say that.
Yeah.
You don't remember being in the crib. That's not a fucking thing.
Yeah.
Repressed memories are, it was a sham decades ago for therapists to convince everybody that their parents abused them so they could soak more money out of them. It's a really awful thing that happened in the soft sciences that it's probably damaged their credibility in actual sciences literally for decades.
I think you're dead on.
All right, so prevent me from getting into a big rant on that. What happens at the end of our show?
We talk about the website, which would be doublefeatureshow.com, and we talk about the email, which we already mentioned, but you can email us the films that have taken inspiration from the chicken scene in Rebel Without a Cause. That would be
ripped them off. That's something you can say. It's fine. They've stolen the scene. Paid tribute, I think. What's that that fancy word?
Homage.
That's the one people like.
We'll call it double feature.
Mispronounced.
We'll call it doublefeatureshow@gmail.com.
Being the year of the crowdsource, we also have some executive producers to thank for help making every fucking show possible. And that is Lucas Duvall, Enrique, Mike Shaw, Dust, and Eric Tachek. So thanks a ton to both you guys and to Tim Kaiser, who, of course, everyone will know as the guy from the greatest video on YouTube, Hello Gracie Executive Koala, which you can find at tinyurl.com/HelloGracie.
And then after that, we usually talk about what we're doing next time. And it is my pleasure to announce that we're doing a couple of musicals. Next week on Double Feature, we're going to be doing Lars von Trier's Dancer in the Dark.
Yeah.
And we're going to be pairing that with Prince's Purple Rain.
So you call them musicals and I'll show up next week and call you a fucking liar.
I'd prefer not to. Watch more fucking film.
Bye.